Support for Small Joys comes from the Columbus Foundation, celebrating the creativity that inspires and strengthens the Central Ohio community every day. More at columbusfoundation.org. Support also comes from the Greater Columbus Arts Council's Columbus Makes Art.
From WOSU Public Media, this is Small Joys. I'm Hanif Abdurraqib, and welcome to Season 2. We're excited to be back. It's been a long time away, but I've been thrilled to get back into this and talk to some folks and kind of expand the definition of joy and how to live it and to kick things off. My guest is Jasmine Warga. Jasmine is a critically acclaimed writer of middle grade and young adult fiction. Much of her work tells the stories of first and second generation immigrants in the United States. In her novel, Other Words for Home, 12-year-old Jude navigates an unfamiliar world after fleeing war in Syria for Cincinnati. The book won several awards, including the 2020 Newbery Honor. We discussed that book and her other novels, but we began with the discussion of her Cincinnati roots and, specifically, the long-standing debate over Cincinnati chili. So I have, to be clear, I have no real strong, passionate feelings on this, but are you like a Skyline person or a Gold Star person, or do you have no preference between the two? Are you not a chili person?
Yeah, so I am a Skyline person, but that becomes complicated because I'm also a Cincinnatian of Jordanian ancestry, and right. It's a Jordanian family that owns Gold Star chili. So my dad, used to like hang out in a lot of Gold Star chilies when he first came to Cincinnati, but he personally prefers Skyline, and so we were always a Skyline family.
I feel like there's a way you can sneak Skyline into Gold Star quietly and hang out in the back, maybe. I don't know. I was just in the Cincinnati area, and I was amazed by how many streets or roads where there would be a Gold Star, like a couple storefronts away from a Skyline, which, you know, like, that level of competition seems seems healthy, but also maybe not.
Yeah, no, 100%. And I also think that, so for a long time, like sort of from like ages 14 to 29, I was a vegetarian. And I think that Gold Star won at the vegetarian chili game for a while. So I did like kind of have, would stop more frequently at Gold Stars during that period of my life. But I have to say, like, I'm a Skyline person when I'm going to go and eat actual Cincinnati chili.
A dear, dear friend of mine is also from the Cincinnati area, and she just gets these, you know, now she lives somewhere like where you cannot access Grater's ice cream, at least not like consistently. And so I sometimes have to mail her pints of black raspberry chip. And, you know, what's interesting for me is, so I went to college at Capital University in Columbus, and at the time I was in college, the only ice cream spots were Johnson's and Grater's, like right across the street from the university. And I really struggled with Grater's because the chunks of things in Grater's ice cream are often alarmingly large. And I'm assuming you're a Grater's. This maybe is an unfair assumption, but I'm assuming you're a Grater's person.
That is a very fair assumption to make, yes, 100%. Okay. So,
how do you navigate? Does the largeness of the interior items not bother you at all, or is that a part of the appeal?
Yeah, I wonder if that's just like we are accustomed to what we've known since we were young, right? And so for me, I grew up eating Grater's ice cream, and so my base assumption is that chocolate in ice cream will come in that shapes and sizes. And that's kind of the like unexpected terrain of the adventure of eating ice cream. And so I actually am the opposite, that when I'm eating an ice cream where I feel like it's almost like the chocolate is like perfectly cut or proportioned, I'm confused about what's happening. And it feels like a different experience.
That's fair. Because I grew up with UDF where, you know, United Dairy Farmers ice cream is like very proportioned and all that. So yeah, maybe this is just like a I don't know, there could be a case study on the kind of regional things of ice cream.
Yeah, I think so. But I love that we're starting this talk with Cincinnati's food, because I feel like it's something that people from Cincinnati have very strong feelings about.
They do. I read in Cincinnati. So I had never read in Cincinnati before, which was very odd. I read there last year for the first time at the old historic library, the Mercantile Library. And just casually, while on stage, I mentioned like this ice cream, internal ice cream debate that I've been having with myself. And it really riled people up. And I remembered that Cincinnatians are indeed very intense about their food identity in a way that I think Columbus folks are just not, or maybe Columbus doesn't really have that rich of a, I know we have Jenny's, but we don't have like a historically entrenched ice cream and or chili identity to cling to.
I think that's true. You know, my husband is from the Columbus area, and so he has the same take that you do, that he thinks Cincinnatians are a lot more territorial about our foods. But I also feel like a lot more people come at us about our food. So I feel that's like true. There's, you know, a defensive posture too, right?
Yeah, people do get kind of weird about the chili thing. To me, maybe that's because I grew up in Ohio and then I've known people from Southern Ohio. The chili has never seemed weird. Like aesthetically even, it's never seemed weird. But people do tend to jump on you all for the look of the chili.
Yeah, which I mean, if I if I try to look at it objectively, I think I can understand. But again, it's just something I grew up with, so yeah, I'm like, why not put chili on spaghetti with tons of fluorescent cheddar cheese piled on the top? Also,
I read Other Words for Home last month, which was really cool, and it was, I know this is something cliche to say perhaps, but it's a book that I kind of wish I had access to when I was younger. You know, I grew up, I was raised Muslim, and I was raised Muslim kind of in two, I like to think about it as dividing it into two different frames. I was raised Muslim before 9/11, and then I was kind of a senior in high school and going to college post 9/11. And there's a lot that went into this book that I think would have made sense to me, or would have made the world make sense to me when I was younger. And I'm really curious about how you built the physical world, like the neighborhood of the book, the whole ecosystem of Jude's life in this way that felt really rich. Like, was that something that you saw growing up? Did you grow up in kind of a warm and insular community of immigrant folks, or was that something you had to build out as you were writing the book?
Yeah, well, first, thank you so much for your comment. I think that so many of us who write for young people, right, are always trying to kind of reach in and think about the books that we wanted to be on shelves when we were young that we never found. So that's really meaningful. Thank you. And in terms of the neighborhood in the book, so it's the book takes place in a neighborhood called Clifton, which is a real neighborhood in Cincinnati. It's the neighborhood kind of adjacent to where the University of Cincinnati is. And I was born in Clifton, but I did not grow up there. I spent most until eighth grade, I lived in a small town that is actually separate from Cincinnati, but basically in Cincinnati. It's almost like a suburb. It's called Wyoming, Ohio. And it was not at all, it was not particularly diverse. So there was not sort of the community that Jude comes into. And then we moved to the northern suburbs, the Montgomery area, when I was in eighth grade, and sort of a little bit more diverse than Wyoming, but definitely nothing like Clifton. And I think that in building out Other Words for Home, it was really important to me that I wanted Jude to have that warmth that you're describing. I wanted there to be joy in the book. I think so often we write stories of, particularly of characters of color in young people's literature, oftentimes trauma is at the center. And I think that Jude's story is a really difficult one. And I hope there's honesty in that. I think it's a difficult experience she goes through. But I also wanted to show some joy and warmth, but also show how even neighborhoods like Clifton, which is actually the neighborhood I was living in when I wrote Other Words for Home, which is also, I think, why I chose to set the book there, can have their own struggles, right? Like in the book, her friend's restaurant is vandalized with, you know, terrible xenophobic graffiti and things like that. And that's something that happened in Clifton in the wake of the 2016 election. I think it shook a lot of us that lived in that neighborhood. But this idea, right, of even places that may almost seem sort of utopian in their community feel can have those types of conflicts. I really wanted to set the book there because I wanted to show off like the diversity of America. I think that that was something that I think about a lot when in the world of children's books, we have been having a really long ongoing discussion about what diversity looks like. And Jude is leaving a not particularly diverse environment, right, for a much more diverse environment. And I wanted to highlight that and showcase that. And I felt like Clifton was a wonderful neighborhood to sort of do that.
Yeah. How do you, you said something that really weaves into my next question, because, you know, I work with a lot of young writers and we workshop writing, and it does seem like so many of them are hungry for literature that does what I think Other Words for Home did well, which is offers the reality of a challenging life that does not center that reality on trauma, or trauma is maybe not the vehicle through which that reality is expressed on the page. How do you find that balance? Because I think that it is very easy to veer into telling a story of where harm is done or where someone is enduring challenges, and then kind of perhaps conflating challenge and trauma, which I don't know if those two are... for me, at least in my lived world, those two aren't always the same. And I think we talk about like young writers and what young writers are given or what they understand, that delineation needs to be clear. So how do you as a writer in process figure out how to kind of maneuver that?
I think that's so smart, your idea of, you know, making that delineation between challenge and trauma. And for me, I think that is where that line is. I think it's about perspective, right? Like you and I both have the lived experience of knowing what it was like to be Muslim in this country after 9/11, right? But the way we might write that experience of us experiencing that, I think would come through more through this lens of what did that challenge look like, which has a different texture and fabric to it than if you're, I think it's about the lens through which you're writing it for. I think sometimes when I think of a book that's defined by trauma, the lens is for the reader, you're writing that book for the reader to zero in on that trauma. And for me, the point of Other Words for Home was to zero in on Jude's strength and triumph, right? And that's what's, to me, at the heart of the book, as opposed to her pain. And I think that while her pain, there is pain in the book, it's not what's put on the pedestal, and it's not hopefully the central takeaway of the book. But I do think it's difficult. And I do think it's difficult when also there is a marketing mode, right, that pushes those storylines, because that's also something that there is a wide hunger for in some ways that all of us are, you know, and I am as a reader, I love to read books where people overcome difficult circumstances, right? That's inspiring. And that's sort of the backbone of lots of wonderful stories. But again, I think it's that question of perspective and lens and who is telling the story and for whom is the story for. And I think that's always where, at least what I'm sorting out for myself of does this feel like a real story of a person who has a full voice and a full experience, you know, and I will just think back on my own experiences as a person. Even if I were to write and tell you about the darkest moments in my life, there's always some, you know, facet of joy there, right? Or there's more texture than just trauma. And I think unearthing that and digging to try to find that deeper. But again, I think that comes from really trying to see the full humanity of the character from which you're, for whom story you're telling.
Right. There's, I'm interested in the people I know who write for young readers are very deliberate about the differences between, say, teen novels, middle grade novels, anything younger than that, because, which, you know, for me, You know, I grew up in a household where I was like reading probably stuff I did not need to be reading at, or stuff that was good for me to read, but was more advanced than, you know, what some of my age could have been reading. And so I have a hard time understanding that there is, because of the way that, you know, the brains of young folks work and the way that young folks evolve rapidly and take on the world with this kind of sense of wonder that feeds imagination really intensely. There are these massive differences between writing for teens and writing for middle grade. And you've done both. Like you've written some novels for teens and then you wrote for middle grade readers. What challenges, if any, did you find in terms of making that adjustment? Or was it kind of just like a slight turn of the head?
Yeah, I mean, I think that middle grade is definitely different from young adult in tone and voice and audience. I mean, I think that primarily, most kids read up, right? So right. It's probably different than what you're talking about. And I think a lot of us have this experience of like reading Stephen King when we were in fourth or fifth grade, and that's different. But for the most part, right, middle grade, it's a wide age span, right? They say it's from like third to eighth grade. And so within middle grade, there's also different sections, right? There's younger middle grade, there's pretty like standard middle grade, and then there's upper middle grade. And I think upper middle grade can blur more with YA. Because I think by the time you get to seventh, eighth grade, most of those kids are reading YA, right? And a lot of times by the time we get to 11th grade and up, they're reading just like contemporary fiction. But I think, yeah, I think for me, it's in voice and sensibility. And I think it's less about the content of the book. I actually think some of my middle grade books have handled content and concepts that are as difficult or as challenging as my young adult books do. I think it's just about the tone and voice from which those topics and content are talked about. And like, I feel like middle grade is where my true heart is at, because I think it's that period in adolescence where you are coming into your own awareness and individuality separate from your family, but your family is still a huge part of your world, right? You don't have that like freedom of access in the world that oftentimes you do as a teenager. And since I'm someone who's really interested in writing about family and belonging, middle grade in its like tone and sort of voice is a more natural fit for me in some ways than young adult.
I was really excited. So when I got the book, I made it a point not to like read anything about the book because I just like being delightfully surprised. And when I opened it and saw it was in verse, that was just like, for me, that was thrilling. you know, I wasn't expecting that. And I'm interested to, and we don't have to get too craft heavy, although I would have no problem with that, of course, but that decision making of prose versus verse, or, you know, did you sit down and say you're going to write the book in verse, or did you have it in prose and then step back and say, no, this needs something else?
Yeah. So I always say, for Other Words for Home, I wrote the book wrong, and I wrote the book wrong like four times, right? I was going through heavy edits with my editor. It was in prose. And I could not figure out why. I think, you know, you will understand this. I think other people who write will understand what I'm about to say. But when you are trying to create something, you have this image in your head, right, of what the book is kind of going to feel like and what it's going to sound like. And there's always going to be a gap, right, between what's in your head and what you're able to get out on the page. And our work in through revision and all of those types of things is to try to close that gap as much as we can. And with Other Words for Home, the problem was I just had this huge gap and I couldn't quite figure out why it was there. And then I finally had this moment of realizing that I felt like if I put the book in verse, I might be able to get a little bit closer to that feeling that I was chasing. And it did work. And I think that it worked because, well, it's a book that's in English. There's this suspension of disbelief, right, that's happening, that we know if Jude was actually telling us this story, she'd be telling us the story in Arabic. And I think that verse is a beautiful mode for translanguaging, right? And I love getting to talk with kids at school visits about this, kids who maybe have multilingual abilities or literacies in languages other than English, about how poetry can be a space to kind of find their own voice and use different, like kind of merge two different languages together, because poetry doesn't have so many rules, right? And you can order, you can put your words whatever order you want, and sort of it's a voice first mode. And so unlocking that for me helped me to really unlock the heart of the story that I'd been chasing. I had this feel of what I wanted, but I couldn't excavate that when it was in prose.
That's beautiful. Especially, you know, I grew up, you know, I learned Arabic before I learned English. That was like the first language I learned was Arabic. And I often felt like when I came to English, it felt in a way like I was being cheated out of just the poetics of sound, or the movements of sound, the kind of rich relationship that I had fostered with sound. Of course, I didn't have to leave it alone forever. But I think that there's something that I ask a lot of writers who write for young folks, and it's kind of like, how and what writing brought you to being a writer when you were younger? Were you reading, did you grow up in kind of the Harry Potter era of young adult writing, or were there other books that did it for you as well?
Yeah, you know, I did grow up in the Harry Potter era, but I don't think that I'm one of those kids that Harry Potter made me a reader. You know, I was definitely a reader before I was introduced to Harry Potter. I always say, you know, I grew up in a family of storytellers. My grandmother on my father's side, I only got to meet her two times, but one of my most distinct memories is of her telling me a story about mermaids in the Dead Sea. And I so vividly remember the experience of hearing this story in my grandma's lap, and sort of that delight that we all who love stories know, right, of being in complete suspense, of wanting to know what was going to happen next. And then I also grew up in a household where my mom read to me every night. And so I fell in love quickly with, you know, Roald Dahl books and Charlotte's Web. And then once I was able to read on my own, I really think like Meg Cabot, Princess Diaries, I lived in that world. And I think as sort of middle school is really hard for me. You know, I didn't feel like I fit in. I struggled a lot socially, and books were a place I could escape into and felt a lot of comfort. And so, you know, I devoured The Giver and lots of other Lois Lowry books. I loved Sharon Draper's work. I loved Margaret Haddix's work, who's another Ohio author, running out of time. And I would just devour those books. And so I devoured the Harry Potter books for sure and loved them. And I think the cultural phenomenon of that can't be overstated, you know, that anticipation of getting to go to the bookstore when the new one was coming out, and that everyone was excited about those books, made me like it was a way of belonging for me. But I loved other books as much, if not more, that I was reading when I was young. I think it was more that feeling of chasing an understanding of the world, because the world confused me. And it was in books that I feel like I was sort of able to find people who are asking those same types of questions about belonging.
I also read The Shape of Thunder. And one, I do want to say, it seems like you, and I get this sometimes, but it seems like you really write at a intense pace, you know, for the books to be as kind of sharp and brilliant and inventive as they are. I was like, wow, there's just like a book a year. That's impressive in a way that I cannot process. But with The Shape of Thunder, when I was young, did not really understand grief. And I think that it is because, you know, like I lost my mother when I was young, but that isn't, loss alone does not like allow you to understand grief. You kind of need some other container with which to explore it. And I think that in a lot of the books I had access to when I was young, you know, grief was kind of shied away from, or at least the books that were supposedly written for me or with me in mind. I really adored The Shape of Thunder because it presents a, again, like real experience of grief, or and like guilt and shame, but also offers up friendship as a balm for it, which, you know, I don't know. I think like there's a way that young people, I see it now when I work with them, talk to them, can retreat into themselves when grief is something that they are wrapped in. And I'd still do that now as a not so young person. I was interested in asking kind of what brought you to telling that story, particularly because it just seemed so it seems so unique. The material in the book seems so unique, at least for what I knew and understood in my understanding of how grief could be presented to young people.
Yeah, you know, the book, like the initial concept of the book was actually inspired by my own experience as a parent. So when I first got the idea for the book, we were still living in the city of Chicago, and we were in an apartment across the street from an elementary school. And it was brought to my attention that the elementary school was having an active, like, shooter drill, right? A lockdown drill. And at the time, my oldest daughter was only 3, but I realized really soon she would be going to this school and I would have to have a conversation with her about this type of drill. And I felt at a loss for words. You know, I didn't know how to explain how I was going to explain to her that she lives in a kind of world where not only that happens, but it happens with the frequency that we have drills around that now. And also that that's been our solution, right? That the responsibility has been sort of pushed on to young people in that way. And so I was thinking about responsibility, right? And then I was doing so many school visits for Other Words for Home, and I was noticing how every school is designed around this issue now, right? Like how many ways you have to check in and just the way the classrooms are numbered. And I started just having kind of informal talks with young people and realized how much anxiety so many of them were caring about this issue, but felt like it was something that made them really uncomfortable to talk about. And then that kind of intersects with the way that I feel about grief and the way that we handle grief as a country, that it's something that makes all of us uncomfortable, right? I think that before I had really experienced grief as with adult consciousness, sort of getting back to what you were talking about, right, of loss doesn't necessarily, isn't necessarily the same as understanding like the, like a full weight of grief, and different points in your life, right, of different levels of consciousness. But basically, I realized from going through this, when I was in my early 20s, I unexpectedly lost one of my very, very best friends. And from going through that experience, I learned that really all I wanted to do at that time was talk about my friend, right? But all the other people around me who didn't know my friend didn't want to talk about my friend with me because they thought that would make me upset or that would make me uncomfortable. And so this idea of why do certain things make us uncomfortable and why can't we talk about them? And what does it look like if we are actually brave enough to sit in our discomfort? And then is that really what books help us to do, right? Crack open those types of conversations that make a lot of us uncomfortable. So I think that that's sort of, you know, books are sort of like snowballs, right? That inspiration comes from lots of different places. But if I were to sort of pull it back now and analyze it, that would kind of be the play-by-play of the momentum that sort of brought the inspiration for The Shape of Thunder, was sort of thinking about how our discomfort sort of, I think, has failed us as a society, especially around the issue of gun violence, of being able to really talk about it and talk about what it means and why it's such a normalized type of violence in America now.
Yeah, yeah. And in terms of the rate at which you write, I mean, are you, what's your process from book to book? Are you someone who, as you're working on one book, the next book is already kind of, you know, being grown? Or you know, do you write two books at a time? I don't know anyone who effectively writes two books at a time, but I'm just amazed by not only the body of work and the quality of work, but the rate at which the work arrives.
Well, you're so kind because you're actually catching me in a moment where I'm feeling very down on myself that I'm not as fast as I feel like I should be. So I'm kind of on the pace of, I have a book every 2 years. And in young people, in publishing for young people, lots of my friends and colleagues have a book every year. And I did do that. So Other Words for Home came out 2019. The Shape of Thunder came out 2021. And A Rover Story just came out this past fall in 2022. But I will be hard pressed to make this deadline to have a book for 2024. But usually for me, I work on one book at a time, but I have a lot of ideas. I'm a daydreamer. And so I have a notebook full of ideas. And part of my process, even when I'm working on another project, to sort of keep joy in my creative process and excitement is I will doodle in my idea notebook about things that I'm thinking about, possible characters in the story or just concepts. And so then by the time it comes to choose what my next idea is, lots of times I have some that I've been thinking on. But I can also end up in the situation I'm at now where I thought that I had my concept and I've just realized that I need to blow it up and start again. And so it's sort of, I guess I'm a collector. And so I do some of that collecting of ideas and inspiration while, you know, revising the book that I'm actively working on, with the hope of sort of getting that jump start, but it doesn't always pan out that way as is what is sort of the position I'm finding myself in right now.
In terms of, you know, to kind of zoom out in think about process as it relates to the everyday life, if we are to believe that, you know, living well is also something that feeds into the writing. How are you finding, you know, in the past year or so, or as you are kind of in this space of like, I need to blow this up and start again, how are you finding kind of small pleasures in the everyday? Are they arriving to you easily, or do you have to like work at them?
I think for me, it's about having interests outside of writing. And the problem is that for me, my biggest identity is a reader, right? I feel like at the core of myself, I'm a reader before I'm a writer. I think my writing stems from being a reader. But that doesn't really save you, right, in terms of not feeling like you're always thinking about work. And so for me, some interests outside of writing, we've already shout out Cincinnati, but I'm a Cincinnati Bengals fan, and so these past 2 years have been, well, we're still reeling a little
they've been great. I was a Bengals fan for a very long time, and I lived through the like Andy Dalton era, and it's been fascinating to see the past couple of years.
And so that has consumed a lot of my energy and time, and but it's fun, right? And for me, the thing is the Bengals are also this feeling of family. So even when we were terrible, which was most of my life, it was every Sunday at 1 o'clock, my whole family would watch the Bengals game together and we would eat pizza. And so now whenever the Bengals are playing, the family chat is going, right? No matter where we are. And so for me, that's something that brings me joy. I'd also say, I feel like everything's coming back to Cincinnati, but I love music and I'm going to claim the Nationals a Cincinnati band. I know they're Brooklyn band, but
they're one of ours. They're a Cincinnati band.
Yeah. So, and Joy, like they just recently released a new song. We're getting a new album, reading the news around that, like reading a lot of, so I read a lot of music and sports journalism, if that makes sense. As a way that is different from, that doesn't feel as work related to me in terms of like my reading, because it's not a novel and it's definitely not for young people specifically. And so those types of things bring me a lot of joy and connect me back to, you know, where I'm from and myself as a kid. And I think that that is a big part of fueling the type of work that I do, is always reconnecting with my 10, 11, 12 year old self.
That is very wonderful. Can I ask just one more question about broadly? I'm interested in the, I don't know why this interests me, but I'm always interested whenever someone has won a big award, I'm interested in hearing about the process of how they found out, because it's so strange sometimes. With the Newbery, you won the Newbery Honor, which is very large and very cool. Was there a weird way you found out, or was it just kind of like a run-of-the-mill phone call or email?
Okay, so kind of the answer is yes and yes. So the Newbery, and I don't know if it's the same way you can actually tell me in the world of like, what should we call them, grown-up books? Adult books like sounds strange to me to say, so grown-up books. but for the Newbery, like it is kind of, you know, it's way more niche than sort of like the Oscars, but there's a lot of like fanfare running up to it, right? Because lots of schools do like mock Newberries and librarians post their predictions. And so in the year that Other Words for Home came out, I was getting tons of emails from really nice and well-meaning librarians saying, you're on our Mock Newbery list, will you Zoom with our class, blah, blah. So it was in my head a little bit, which is not great. I feel like sometimes with good things in publishing, the my best moments have been when it's entirely unexpected, right? So you didn't have any of the sort of anxious feeling leading up to it. So it wouldn't be honest to say, so the Newbery is announced at ALA, the American Library Association's midwinter conference. And so that year leading up to it, I definitely knew what that date was. And I so vividly remember feeling like very stressed out that weekend, because it's that cycle that I think all of us who create things, you know how to go through, which is, this is an insane thing to believe could happen. Like, and why am I feeling stressed about this? To, oh my gosh, how amazing would that be if this happened? Right. To cycling back through. And so I never sleep with my phone. And then I was like, is it jinxy to have my phone? Because I'd heard that they call you really early in the morning, was sort of the rumor if it went. So I did have my phone, and but I guess I forgot to turn the ringer on. So what I remember is at 4:30 in the morning, my husband nudging me awake, being like, your phone is ringing.
4:30 in the morning?
Yeah, 4:30 in the morning.
Whoa.
And I answer the phone. Well, at first I see that it's from Philadelphia, the phone call, and I knew that's where the conference was. And my heart kind of, you know, did this jump. And then I heard the chair's voice on the phone saying it was John Newbery committee. And I think I started crying. It feels still so unreal to me. What I remember is getting off the phone call and texting my agent editor, because I was so afraid to wake them up, and saying like, hey, I think this happened, but I don't know. And I don't know if they can change their mind. And then my editor responding immediately being like, we know. Because I guess like they find out before you do. So it was a phone call, a generic run-of-the-mill phone call, but because it came so early, and I'll always remember that, I think it's so sweet that Greg is the one who woke me up, because he couldn't sleep because he really believed that it was going to happen, which I think is really nice. Whereas like I'd gotten myself to sleep by really calming myself down that this was an insane, you know, thing to hope for. As you know, I think awards are they're wonderful when they happen, and they can mean so much for a career. And I'm so grateful, you know, it really has given me this, there's never security in a creative field, but it's given me this feeling, a secure feeling than I had before. While also recognizing, you know, how fickle and serendipitous it is, right? And how many deserving books there are every year.
Wonderful. I love those stories. Those are my favorite stories. Thank you for sharing that with me. And Jasmine, thank you for your time. It's been wonderful to talk to you. And I'm such a big fan of your work. I was really excited to get to dive into it. And I'm glad I did.
Oh, well, thank you. Same right back at you.
It started as a normal day.
What if the truth about the greatest tragedy of your life was kept secret from you?
Huge explosion occurred.
This is the story of a scandal deliberately buried in the chaos of the Iraq War.
What really just happened?
Listen to NPR's Embedded podcast and its latest series, Taking Cover.
At the end of every episode, I take some time to share one of my small joys, and you'll be hearing this hopefully with what will feel like spring. It will calendar-wise be the beginning of spring, but I hope it feels like that outside. And during the winter, I take to a bunch of small tasks to kind of occupy my mind and keep my spirit uplifted during the early darkness and the cold and being indoors and all of that. And this year, I've been working on restoring an old Swedish Mora clock from the late 1800s that I got a few years ago, and it hasn't been working. It's been sitting not working in my house since, I would say, late 2020. And I don't know anything about restoring clocks. I've been doing a lot of research and calling a lot of friends and calling in a lot of favors and calling in a lot of help. And the real gift in this process, you know, a couple years ago, I upholstered a chair on my own. I've built a picture frame. I don't know how to do any of these things, but I enjoy kind of stumbling towards the knowledge. Now, the process of restoring the clock is not going great. It's still in its infancy after all these months, but I've really enjoyed just playing with the inner workings of something that is fairly ancient compared to me and compared to everything else in my house. It's been good to revel in the kind of quietness and stillness and patience it takes because it's an old clock, because it has a bunch of small working parts that all kind of come together to make one large working machine. It's been really cool to kind of get into the heart of something and try to tinker around with its small parts, hoping that those small parts feed into the machinery of a larger part. And I don't know how it's going to end up. It might take me, like, I might be back at this next winter. I'm a little bit busier now, so I haven't had a lot of time to spend with it like I did in the winter. So it's possible that by the time next winter comes around, this will still be a restoration project that I'm in the throes of. But it has been fun. You know, some of this process is about failure, is about failing at something that I don't know how to do, but I learn my way as I do it. So much of my life, I think, is kind of predicated on taking on things that I know I can at least understand. And it's good every once in a while to kind of jump into uncertainty and fight your way out of it. So that has been a really joyful thing for me. Small Joys is a production of WOSU Public Media and part of the NPR network. The show is produced and edited by Michael DeBonis. Sound engineering by Eric French. Nick Hauser is Chief Content Director of Digital Media. Special thanks to Leticia Wiggins for editorial support. And thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate it on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. We'll be back next week with more Small Joys.